Several and a half metric miles northeast of Sligo, in the Republic of Ireland, dwells the microcephalic community of Pacoon. Split by a cascading stream, her body on earth, her feet in water, the whole village woke one morning to an unexpected burst of hot weather. Children fought for turns at the iron pump, their giggling white bodies splashing in the cool water from its maternal maw. Bone-dreaming dogs steamed on the pavements, and pussycats lay, bellies upwards, drinking the gold effulgent warmth. Old Danny Conlon was already setting up the evening edition with ink-tinted fingers. "Hottest day in living memory," was the headline, and it took something like that to get the Pope off the front page. Nearby, Castle Hill groaned under the weight of its timeless ruins, while the distant mountains came and went in the mid-morning haze. Gleaming off-white at the foot of the castle were the crumbling faces of the old peat-cutters' cottages, condemned as unfit to live in, except during thunderstorms and depressions. The year after the Troubles, the Irish Free State Government had bequeathed the cottages to those who would help rid Holy Ireland of the English, the Tans, and, for that matter, anybody. One such beneficiary was the Dan Milligan, son of a famous paternity order. With a roof over his head, he had ceased work, living off his pension and his wits, both hopelessly inadequate. This sun-barbered morning, the Milligan lay full length on the grass, head against the wall, his eyes lost in the shadow of his cap. His thoughts, few that they were, lay silent in the privacy of his head. "I think," he reflected, "I think I'll bronze me limbs." He rolled his trousers kneeward, revealing the like of two thin, white, hairy affairs of the leg variety. He eyed them with obvious dissatisfaction. "Holy God! What are these, then? Eh?" He looked around for an answer. "What are they?" "Legs." "Legs? Whose legs?" "Well, yours."
"Mine? And who are you?"
"I'm the, the author."
"Otter? Otter? Did you write these legs?"
Yes."
"Well, I don't like them. I don't like them at all. I could have written better legs myself. Now, did you write you's legs?"
"No."
"Ah, so. You got someone else to write your legs. Someone who's a good leg writer, and then you write this pair of crappy old legs for me. Well, mister, it's not good enough."
I'll try and develop them with a plot."
"But it's a diabolical liberty, letting an untrained leg writer loose on an unsuspecting human being like me."
It was a Dublin accent, charged with theatrical innuendo. Like all Irish, he could make good morning sound like a declaration of war, which it usually was. He lay back. The sun grew stronger. "Oh, I must admit you're right nice weather, mister." He held one arm up to the sky and eyed the frayed cuffs of a once-upon-a-time suit. "Oh, it's going home at last. Still, a suit can't last forever." But on reflection, he remembered. It had. The shoulders were padded like angled flight decks. The trouser seat hung a foot below the crutch, and the 28-inch bottoms flapped around his legs like curtains. He shook his head sadly. "Oh, they don't make suits like this anymore. I suppose the age of Beau Brummel is dead." He recalled the day he'd bought it, the bride-to-be waiting at the church, while he, the groom, was still at home, standing naked in front of a mirror, a top hat angled jauntily on his head. "By gar, she's getting value for money," he said.
"Hurry up, Dan, lad,"
the father was saying.
"You're late, and you can't get married in that nude."
"And why not?" said the Milligan, admiring his honeymoon appendages.
"Adam and Eve done it. And look at the fine honeymoon they had."
"Thank God," said the old man. "Thank God there's were no press photographers at that wedding, or the Holy Bible had been banned in Ireland forever, perhaps even longer."
But Milligan's sunny dreaming was soon curtailed with a loud as a bucket of evil-smelling slops hit him square in his sleeping face.
"And the smar, where'd that come from, you lazy bugger?"
"God forgive you for that," sputtered the now reeky Milligan. "Me hat. Look at me hat. If you don't get the Marwell soon, I'll...
She made the sign of slow, manual strangulation, and Millie noticed that of a sudden there were no birds in the sky, and the brown dog had fled.
"Darling," he whined, "he know full well there's no work around these parts," and he pointed as far as the fence. "Poor Father Rodden is still looking for someone to cut the grass. Now, I'm going in there for 5 minutes, and if you're still here when I come out in half an hour..."
Like an amen, the cottage door slammed after her. All the world went quiet.
Holy God! Who in blazes was that?
That was your darling little wife.
Wife? Wife? Agony swept across his face. Man alive, I thought that was the man. Good God, did you see them arms? What kind of a writer are you? First me legs, now that great hairy creature there. Holy Christ! I'd better get out of the job.
The Dan Milligan cycled tremendously towards the church of St. Teresa of the Little Flowers, and leaving the area known as his wife, he brightened up a little. Man alive, though, the size of her, she's a danger to shipping. Away down the lumpy road he pedalled, his right trouser leg being substantially chewed to pulp in the chain. His voice was raised in that high, nasal Irish tenor, known and hated the world over.
"Oh, I once knew a Judy in a Dublin town. Her eyes were blue and her hair was brown. One night in the grass I got her down, and I..."
The rest of the words were lost to view as he turned a bend in the road, and the world was a better place for music. Further along, from an overhanging branch, a pure-blooded Irish crow watched the Milligan approach. It also watched him hit the pothole, leave the bike, strike the ground, clutch the shin, scream the agony, and swear the word.
"Ah!" said the crow. "And balls!" said Milligan.
Peering intently from behind a wall was something that Milligan could only hope was a face. The fact that it was hanging from a hat gave credulity to his belief.
"Are you all right there, Milligan?" said the face in the hat.
"Oho," said Milligan. "'Tis Murphy. Tell me, why are you wearing that terrible-looking trilby?"
"Oh, 'cause we sold the hat stand, and there's no place to hang it. I heard the crash, you know. I examined myself, and I knew it wasn't me.
Oh, you was right, because it was me. I fell off me bicycle. Thank heaven, the ground broke me fall."
"Oh, yes. Oh, it's very handy like that," said Murphy, settling his arms along the wall.
"Oh, dear, dear," said Milligan, getting to his feet. "I scratched all the paint off the toe of me boot."
"Oh, is that right, then? Do you paint your boots?"
"Ah, 'tis true. 'Tis the most economical way. Sometimes I paint some brown, and when I have enough of that, I paint some black again. That way, you see, people think you got more than one pair, see?"
No, said Murphy solemnly. "Oh, no. I don't like interfering with nature. The natural colour of the boots is black as God ordained, and any other colour, and a man is asking for trouble. I'll stick with the inventor of the black boot. After all, they don't show the dirt."
"Well, that's my argument. Black don't show the dirt. Brown ones don't show the mud, and a good pair of green boots don't show the grass."
"By God, you got something there," said the Murphy. "But what about then when you paint them white for your cricket? What then don't they show?"
"But then they don't show your feet," said Milligan, throwing himself onto the bike and crashing down on the other side. "Ah!" said the crow. "Balls!" said Milligan. "And I'll be on me way." He remounted and pedalled off.
The day brewed hotter now. It was coming noon. The hedgerows hummed with small things that buzzed and bumbled in the near heat. From the cool woods came a babble of chirruping birds. Slowfully Milligan pedalled on his way. Great billy ballers of perspiration were running down his shins into his boots, where they escaped through the lace holes as steam. "Now," thought the Milligan, "why are me legs going round and round and round, eh?
I don't think it's me doing it. In fact, if I had me way, they wouldn't be doing it at all. But there they are, going round and round.
What then was the driving force behind those legs? The wife. That was it. That's what's driving them round and round. That's the truth. These legs are terrified of me wife.
It was a disgrace how a fine mind like his should be taken along by a pair of terrified legs. If only his mind had a pair of legs of its own, they'd be back at the cottage being bronzed in the Celtic sun.
Oh, dear, this weather. Oh, I'd never known it so hot. It felt as though he could have grabbed a handful of air and squeezed the sweat out of it. I wonder, he mused, how long I can go on losing me body fluids at this rate before I'm struck down with the dehydration.
The answer to me problem, he said gleefully, drawing level with the front door of the Holy Drunkard pub. Hello! He shouted to the letterbox. Hello!
An upstairs window flew up like a gunport, and a pig of a face stuck itself out.
What do you want, Milligan?
Milligan doffed his cap.
Ah, Mrs. O'Toole, you're looking more lovely than ever. Is there any chance of a cool laid basin for a thirsty traveller?
Piss off!
Said the lovely Mrs. O'Toole.
Oh, what a witty tongue you have today, said Milligan, gallant in defeat.
Gah! Said a crow.
Balls! Said Milligan, and aim once again for the distant church of St. Teresa. Father Patrick Rudden paused as he trod the gravel path of the church drive. He ran his kerchief round the inside of his holy clerical collar. Then he walked slowly to the grave of the late Miss Griselda Strains and pontifically lowered his immense ecclesiastical rump onto the worn slab, muttering a silent apology to the departed lady, but reflecting it wouldn't be the first time she'd had a man on top of her, least of all one who apologized as he did. He was a tall, handsome man, touching 50, but didn't appear to be speeding. His stiff white hair was yellowed with frequent applications of anointment oil. The width of his neck and shoulder suggested a rugby player, and the broken nose confirmed it, which shows how wrong you could be, as he had never played the game in his life. The clock in the church tower said 4:32, as it had done for 300 years. It was right once a day, and that was better than no clock at all. How old the church was, no one knew. It was, like Mary Brannigan's black baby, a mystery. Written records went back to 1530. The only real clue was the discovery of a dead skeleton under the ante-chapel. Archaeologists from Dublin had got wind of it and come racing up in a lorry filled with little digging men, instruments and sandwiches.
Oh, 'tis the bones of an Ionian monk, said one grey professor, and I think he is about 1,500 years old.
Which accounts for him being dead, said the priest, and that was that.
Money, that was the trouble. Money. The parish was spiritually solvent, but financially bankrupt. The Lord will provide, but to date he was behind with his payments.
Money.
Father Rudden had tried everything to raise funds. He even went to the bank.
Don't be a fool, Father, said the manager. Put that gun down.
Money. There was the occasion when he had promised to make fire to fall from heaven. The church had been packed. At the psychological moment, the priest had mounted the pulpit and called loudly, I command fire to fall from heaven. A painful silence followed. The priest seemed uneasy. He repeated his invocation much louder. I command fire to fall from heaven. The sibilant voice of the verger came wafting hysterically from the loft.
Just a minute, Father. The cat's pissed on the matches.
It had been a black day for the church. Money! That was the trouble. His own shoes were so worn, he knew every pebble in the church drive by touch. He poked a little gold nut of cheap tobacco into his pipe. As he drew smoke, he looked at the honeyed stone of St. Teresa, the church he had pastored for 30 years. The clanking sound of a male bicycle frame interrupted the priest's wistful attention. There, coming up the drive, was the worst Catholic since Genghis Khan.
Ah! Top of the morning to you, Father, Milligan said, dismounting.
Well, well, Dan Milligan. There was surprise and pleasure in the priest's voice.
By God, Father, what do you think of this weather?
Oh, it's hot all right, said Father Rudden, relighting his pipe. Producing a small clay decoy pipe, Milligan started to frantically pat his empty pockets.
Oh, here, said the priest, throwing him his tobacco pouch.
Oh, thank you, Father. An unexpected little treat.
Now, Milligan, what is the purpose of this visit?
Well, Father, he began, puffing to a match. Well, I... Puff, 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 puff. I've come to see, puff, 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 if this grass-cutting job, puff, puff, is still going. The inquiry shook the priest into stunned silence. In that brief moment, the Milligan leaped onto his bicycle with a, "Ah, well, so the job's gone. Goodbye." The priest recovered quickly, restraining Milligan by grasping the seat of his trousers. "Oh, steady, Father! Them's more than me trousers you're clutching."
"I'm sorry, Milligan," said the priest, releasing his grip. "We celibates are inclined to forget them parts."
"Well, you can forget mine for a start," thought Milligan.
"There's plenty of work to be done, Dan," the priest was saying, interrupting Milligan's painful thoughts.
He pointed to four sentinel scythes standing in the corner like steel flamingos.
"Oh," Milligan backed away. "They look awful heavy, Father. Would you like to lift one of them to see if me fears are well-founded?" "Saints alive, Milligan, there's no weight in them at all, man," said the priest, lifting one up and making long, sweeping strokes. "See, no weight in them at all," he repeated, holding his groin for a suspected rupture. He stood at the door and pointed out. "You can start against the wall there and work inwards." "Oh, if only I was younger." So saying, the priest made off up the path.
As he did, Milligan thought he heard suppressed laughter coming from the holy man.
As Milligan labored unevenly through the afternoon, long overgrown tombstones came to light. R.I.P. Tom Conran O'Rourke. Not dead, just sleeping. Milligan chuckled irreverently. He's not kidding anyone but himself. The sun bled its scarlet way to the horizon, and the skies nodded into evening. The birds flew to their secret somewheres, and bats grew restless at the coming of night. Milligan puzzled at the church clock. 4:32? Good heavens, it gets dark early around here.
How are you getting on there, Dan?
At the sound of the priest's voice, Milligan put on a brief, energetic display of hoeing. The priest blew his nose.
Fun! Fun!
It went in deep, melodious E-flat.
I think you've done enough for today, Dan. It's nearly 7.
7? Milligan cursed in his head. Trust me to work to a stopped clock.
You mustn't kill yourself, Milligan.
Well, I'm in the right place if I do.
A cool breeze blew in from the Atlantic, fetching the smell of airborne waves. The first ectoplasms of evening mist were forming over the river, and here and there fishers mouthed an O at the still surface. The Angelus rang out its iron prayer, and Murphy, out in his field, dropped his hoe and joined his hands in prayer. At the sound of the church bell, the near godless Milligan trundled his bike towards the holy drinker. The pub door flew in, and a fast stream of silent drinkers moved into position. The air was immediately machine-gunned with a rapid series of orders.
Guinness, whiskey, stout, gin, beer, rum, port, beer, stout, stout.
There followed a silence as the day's trouble were washed away with great liver-crippling draughts of alcohol. The first one to feel a powerful benefit was the blind George Devine.
Good evening, all. It's been a lovely day, has it not?
And he spoke with the authority of a man who had seen it all. O'Brien was rattling the bar with his empty glass.
A drop of the real hard stuff, no, Ned, he instructed the spotty, thin pot boy.
O'Brien was the head man round these parts. He ran the village grocery and took bets. He also had money in the bank, a cousin in America, and a girl in the family way. 40 years old, though a little puffy in the face, he was still a handsome man. Like all men in Pakoon, he was married, but single after 6 at night. O'Brien was joined by his old friend, Dr. Sean Goldstein. So Semitic did he look, that even at all Hebrew parties, people would say, "Who's that Jewish-looking fella?" He had just come from the ailing Dan Doonan, where the patient had been complaining of a slight improvement. "Oh, he's dying for sure," said Goldstein, parting a Guinness with his nose. "It's a coronary condition. It's just a matter of time, which I suppose is the sentence we're all under." O'Brien lit a cigarette.
"I sometimes think," he said, mixing his words with smoke, "it would be kinder to do away with the incurables."
"Oh, nobody's incurable," Goldstein was quick to reply. "It's just that we don't know the cure. And remember, what's good for the dying is sometimes bad for the living."
What's that? Well, if he dies, I'm worse off. Work it out for yourself.
O'Brien paused, then continued his drink, deep in thought. In the corner, little Mr. Pierce was holding forth.
Oh, yes. I was in the fighting all the way. In the fighting, and the English, they never caught me.
He was speaking to a Mr. Fogarty. Now, Fogarty wore a long, foul, ragged black overcoat, which seemed to have grown on him. It was secured around the middle with repeatedly knotted bits of string, from which hung various accoutrements, a mug, hairbrush, spoon, flyswat, a tin opener. An outsized, greasy brown ruby, set lower in his forehead, gave him the appearance of having no top to his head, which in fact he hadn't. He was the son of a long line of camp followers. He had been relieved of his post as a lighthouse keeper at the Shale Rock when he drew the blinds to stop the light shining into the poor sailor's eyes. His father had been drowned after a brawl on the edge of a whiskey vat. Not that he couldn't swim. He'd tried to drink his way out. Alcoholic poisoning was the coroner's verdict.
I tell you, he is so beautifully preserved, it seemed a shame to bury him, said the amazed mortician.
Yes, went on Mr. Pierce. I was wounded twice, once by me own side. You see, the Tans and the police were looking for rebels, and one night we could hear them searching the place, all drunk. Finally, they break into our place. They smashes up the furniture, and lets fly a few rounds into the ceiling, and into me loft, and I guess it in the leg. In a few days, it goes gangrene, so they smuggles in Goldstein, and he offs with it. It was bloody murder. You should have seen the bill he sent me.
He tapped his wooden leg with his pipe.
It's hollow, and you know why.
No, said Fogarty, nodding his head.
Well, Michael Leary wanted someone to smuggle hand grenades to the police cordon, so I hollows out me leg, and I travels the bombs in that, and, he laughed, they never caught me.
Fogarty looked at Mr. Pierce. Pierce looked at Mr. Fogarty. It appeared to Fogarty that Mr. Pierce had finished.
Oh, he said.
Oh, said Mr. Pierce. I tell you a tale of Irish courage and heroism, and all you can say is oh.
Fogarty seemed to struggle with his mind. Gradually a pathetic smile spread over his face.
Fish, he said.
Fish,
said Mr. Pierce. What about fish?
It's different from all.
Mr. Pierce just looked at Fogarty. There was something amiss in this lad. Only that day someone had said good morning to him, and he seemed at a loss for a reply.
You'd have been in real trouble if them bombs had gone up in your leg, mate. Your ass would have been halfway up your back.
The voice came booming from Thomas Rafferty, who stood 6 foot square. Grinning at his own little joke, he upended the box of dominoes onto the table.
I'll keep you a game, said Fogarty eagerly. No, you bloody will don't. I beat you last time. I know you did, and I haven't lived that down yet. Being beat by you is an admission of insanity, you stupid bloody idiot.
Well, no offence, men, mark you.
The pub door opened, and in bore a podgy police uniform carrying the body of Sergeant McGillicuddy. There was a rush for the door. He held up a calming hand, but was knocked flat by the exodus.
I'll be glad when this town gets prison cells with locks on. Now,
he felt in his breast pocket, I'm here to read a brief notice. He removed his helmet and inadvertently placed it over Blind Divine's beard.
To all citizens of the Free State, next week, military and civil members of the Ulster Boundary Commission will be passing through this area. Any hostility towards them will be penalised with fines from a shilling up to death.
Ah, thank you.
He accepted a free drink from Mr. O'Toole.
Cheers,
he said, and drained it to eternity. Blind Divine was groping.
Some thieving swine stolen me beer, he shouted.
You might have drunk it.
I never forget any beer I drink.
He flourished his stick, striking Fogarty a sickening blow on the shin. Oh, screamed Fogarty, clutching his elbow.
Here, man, said O'Toole, giving Divine a beer. Drink this from the house and calm down.
Well, I'll be on my way now, said McGillicuddy, picking up his helmet.
What's that then? Said O'Toole, pointing to a glass of beer revealed.
Oh, that's mine, said Fogarty, who was not such a fool after all.
Come on, Stan, lad, said O'Brien after the policeman left. Give us one of your love songs, one of them with all them strains.
Despite the absence of a piano player, the lad came and stood dutifully by the mute instrument.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to sing the lonely song, Eileen, my Eileen.
He raised the lid of the beer-saturated piano, struck a note, and started singing an entirely different one. The lad opened a red raw mouth, revealing great harp strings of saliva. With the arrival of the first uncertain note, the lad's eyes glazed over as though a stricture of the bowels was imminent. The singer's body went rigid, a series of stomach convulsions ensued, then the whole body quivered.
You are my queen.
Puzzled spectators observed that his lower jaw remained static. It was the top of his head that moved. He indulged in an orgy of meaningless gestures, revealing a ragged armpit from which protruded tufts of brown hair. Veins stood out in his forehead, and the sweat ran down his face. As purple with strain, he braced himself for the last great note. In that tacit moment, the observant Fogarty spoke.
Hey, mister, you got a bogey up your nose.
It was to be a solemn occasion, as James Joyce had said, real hairy. In a brown and upstairs room at the Duke of Wellington Hotel, Ireland, to quote an IRA leaflet, was being torn in two by traitors, the last word being in red. At every door and window, standing, sitting, looking, listening, soldiers from both factions stood guard. With the IRA about, nobody was taking any chances, least of all the IRA, who were all home in bed. Inside, several high-ranking, grim-faced boundary commissioners from both sides faced each other across a giant map of Ireland. Lighting the scene was a mean yellow bulb covered with generations of fly specks. Across the map, running from right to left, was a thick red pencil line that terminated just short of the Atlantic. It was the threatened new border. In its path lay sleeping Pacoon. For 10 whole days now, they had argued the last few miles of the frontier. Tempers were frayed, agreements infrequent, and weak bladders put to the test, and Mr. Haggerty was complaining about the Ulster representatives' indecisiveness. You'll all be in the Republic one day, so dare! He thumped the map with a fat, furious fist, displacing numerous flags. Immediately, Mr. Neville Thwick, a thin, veiny, eel-like man with acne, deftly replaced the flags. You'll all be in the Republic one day, repeated Haggerty, without so much as a glance at Thwick's flags, but answered instead by the febrile castrato voice of Mr. Meredith.
Mr. Haggerty,
he repeated as he rose to his feet. One could see how very old he was, how very thin he was, and falling back into his seat, how very weak he was.
Mr. Haggerty,
his pale hands flapping like mating butterflies,
I protest at...
He stopped suddenly, eyes closed, lids quivering, head back. A pause, his face taking on that agonized look of the unborn sneeze.
Sorry about that,
he muttered, wiping his eyes.
No,
he became stronger.
I was saying, yeah,
thundered the unexpected. The convulsion shot his dentures the length of the room. Thud went his head on the table. Down went the flags. In sprang Mr. Thwick and... Oh! Shrieked Mrs. Eels as a set of heavy dentures landed in her lap. Meredith laid back, spit-speckled, white and exhausted, his face folded in two. Mrs. Eels returned his teeth on a plate covered with her kerchief.
No, thank you, dear. I couldn't eat another thing.
With his back to the map, and accompanied by terrifying clicks and clacks, Meredith wrestled to replace his podgical dentures. Finally, he turned to continue his speech, but remained silent. Ah, I see what the trouble is, said Haggerty, pulling down Meredith's lower lip. He's put his choppers in upside down. Someone fetch me a screwdriver.
No, interrupted Mrs. Angel Eels. We've had enough delays. We've got to finish this petitioning today.
There was a murmur of approval.
She glowed inwardly at their acceptance. She was a true daughter of the revolution, a tireless worker for the party, sexually frustrated, and slightly cross-eyed, the last two having something in common. Her late husband, Frederick Mortimer Eales, had been a professional circus midget. Twice nightly, he was fired from a cannon into a net. That, and cleaning out the elephant dung, was his job, though he only got billed for the former. Angel had met him by accident. She ran over him in a gig. Born with an abnormal fear of men, Angel saw in Frederick all the innocence of boyhood. Lying in hospital under drugs from the accident, Frederick had proposed to her. Courting her in public was difficult, as she towered over him by some 3 feet, and he made a point of only meeting her on the side of a hill. But love does something. At the wedding, Angel, for all her plainness, looked beautiful, and even Mr. Eales looked and walked a foot taller. Alas, it was not the last. The honeymoon was fatal. Trying to change a light bulb to a more romantic colour in the bridal suite, Fred balanced on a chair and table, fell back in the dark, broke his neck, and died. Since then, 15 long years ago, Mrs. Eales had no other love, but she had visited many, many circuses. Till now, monkey-faced Mr. Ferguson had said little. Now, drawing a breath, he spoke in a sing-song manner.
May I make a suggestion? We have only this bit here to partition, and the pubs close in 1 hour. Why not let's all put one hand on pencil and draw a line that falls naturally and peacefully into place?
On a show of hands, they accepted his suggestion. In what was meant to be a solemn moment, all hands held the pencil and pulled slowly across the map. All was silent. The room was filled with suspicion. Occasionally a gasp rent the silence as they all strained for the advantage.
Someone's pulling to the benefit of us.
Light, oh light.
Who gave that jerk?
I felt that.
Fine.
Finally, the pencil reached its destination. Faces broke into relieved smiles, and a series of rapid, unplanned handshakes ensued. His hands feel nice, thought Angel. Haggerty rang a bell. A Free State soldier entered the room.
Pardon me, sir, he said respectfully, his face lost in the obscurity of an overlarge cap. There are 2 men outside, says they are the photographers.
Send them in, said the gleeful Haggerty. The soldier saluted, turned smartly about face, still leaving his cap, facing forwards. 2 men entered the room. One was taller than the other, as is often the case in Ireland. The small one proffered a card. Cole Brothers, professional morticians, amateur photographers. The tall one possessed long, bony fingers that crackled and snapped with healthy young rheumatism. I'll scream if he touches me, thought Angel. With polite interest and light conversation, they all watched as the brothers Cole assembled a scaffold of legs and equipment. Captain Clark took to circling the apparatus, pausing now and then to tap the tripod with his regimental cane.
Good. Very, very good.
He tapped once more, and the structure collapsed.
If you'd try not doing that, it would help, said the little Cole. Now, if the fine ladies and gentlemen will take up thoughtful poses, we will record the occasion.
The tall Cole beckoned Mrs. Eales with a crackling finger. If the lady would please be seated.
Just a minute, interrupted white-haired Mr. Brogan. No ill will, mark you, but me being the oldest member here, I think I should be the central figure, me and me fine white head of hair.
He was ignored to a man, him and his fine white head of hair. There were further problems, however, with Mrs. Eales' cross eyes.
If Madam would sit profile, was the respectful suggestion.
Meredith smiled blissfully, forgetting his false teeth. Behind Mr. Thwick, a hatstand appeared to grow from his head.
Keep your nose still, Mr. Ferguson, pleaded the taller Cole. Sorry, lad. It only stops if I stick my finger up it. Then do that, or it will come out blurred.
Ferguson dutifully thrust his finger into position, his bow legs framing the fireplace behind, the flames disappearing up his seat. Stretched majestically across the front, head in hand was handsome Councillor Andrew Burke, completely unaware that he had forgotten to adjust his dress before leaving. I wonder where that draught's coming from, he thought. Mr. Brogan, still in a huff, stood with his back to the camera.
I might as well show me fine white head of hair, he said.
The magnesium flared. Everyone blinked. It was all over. Mrs. Eales married the taller cold brother. Apparently, when posing her, his hand had touched her knee. He survived the honeymoon, which was ruined for her. The hotel manager had been a midget. Now, while the Burkes and the Haggertys were doing their organizing for the Boundary Commission, in Belfast, two young customs officers were packing well-traveled suitcases. Webster was short and handsomish, with ill-cut straight brown hair and grey eyes. All in all, a bit of a ladies' man. One bit in particular. By comparison, Peter Barrington, his tall, blonde, rather wavering roommate, looked slightly effeminate. The two had nothing in common save the English language, and even then Barrington had a superior accent for it.
"A quarter of the engine driving on the outland was," said Barrington, his accent almost obliterating the meaning of the words.
The upper-class sound of it ruffled Webster. He didn't like Barrington, but two sharing a room was cheaper than one. Webster's background was East London. Docks, dirt, and pubs. He'd been born in a Cockney family when Cockneys were perfectly content with their lot, made good workmen, great craftsmen, superb soldiers, and were the first to put up flags for the King and Queen. Unlike Webster, Barrington had been born into a class that denied him the joy of self-accomplishment. It had all been laid on for him. His name was down for Eton 3 years before his birth, and with gilt-edged godparents, his baptism could be seen in the columns of the London Times. Despite all this, he had been cashiered from the guards for a certain incident with a young boy. It had been given 3-inch headlines in all Sunday papers. "This must be stopped," says the front page. Poor Barrington had been exposed to the nation. His mother, Lady Nora, had been singularly unmoved by it all. As she told a reporter,
"I can't understand all the fuss. His father did this sort of thing all the time, and he got on awfully well. But then," she added, "he worked in the Foreign Office."
Lord Barrington himself had been a devout Catholic and a practicing homosexual. As he frequently said, "Practice makes a perfect." Now his son, the Honourable Barrington, had been seconded to the temporary obscurity of the Northern Irish customs. Webster and he were both due to organise a customs post along the new border near Pacoon. "Where the hell is Pacoon?" Webster was about to ask, when there was a combined knocking and opening at the door, the speciality of landladies in need of scandal, as was Mrs. Cafferty.
I'm sorry you're gone at such short notice," she grinned, and handed the £2 bill to Webster.
Webster placed his cigarette on the windowsill and took out a £5 note.
"Oh, I'm sorry we don't take checks, sir."
"Checks? This is a £5 note. Confused and baffled by her ignorance of the higher currency denominations, she backed from the room, clutching the front of her flowered apron.
I'll bring me husband up. He knows all about them things."
Downstairs, his socks singeing in the heat of the near-red stove, dozed the lord and master of the house, Robert Cafferty. Around him, his kingdom. On the stove, a blue-tipped teapot was stewing the last life from its imprisoned leaves. On the mantelpiece, a clockwork Virgin Mary made in Japan.
"Wake up, darling," said Mrs. Cafferty, striking him with her clenched fist. "Look at this."
She waved the £5 note. "Oh," he donned his glasses. It's a check. That's a check, isn't it?"
"That's what I told them, but them says no."
"I'll talk to dems." He pulled up his braces and put his hat on as a sign of authority. "Oh, good morning to you both," said Cafferty, appearing in the doorway, his face still drugged with sleep. "Well, well," he looked round the room in mock surprise. "So, ho, 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 so you're leaving, and without a break, I'm sorry, we don't take checks." "Here, then," said Webster, and hastily counted out 4 brown 10-shilling notes. "Oh, brown, now that's the colour of money," thought Cafferty. "Sorry we don't take checks," he said, leaving the room. They could hear her hitting Cafferty as he stumbled down the stairs back to his kingdom. 1 hour later, Webster and Barrington sat side by side on a hard black leather seat, rocking sleepily on the train to Pacoon. Back at Cafferty's, Webster's cigarette on the windowsill was burning the house down. "Hello, hello, hello, Prudential Insurance," said the smoke-enveloped Cafferty. "Hello? Oh, listen, I want to take a fire policy." Pacoon, what a God-forsaken place. Major Stokes paced the weed-soaked platform, breathing minced oaths. He stopped and beat a rapid military tattoo on his riding boot.
Ouch!
Stepping crisply into the street lamp's crepuscular glow, he took a nickel military watch from his pocket. The military time was 1900 hours. The train was late. He rapped loudly on the ticket office partition. From behind came the sound of a rusty bolt being withdrawn. The partition slid halfway up, jammed, then slammed down again. A second time it rose. This time, framed in the Gothic aperture, was the unshaven, sandwich-chewing face of Station Master Don Feely. He peered into the dark at the Major's wet, white face.
Where are you going to, sir?
I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, good, then you've arrived. Good night.
Wait!
The Major restrained him. I'm waiting for the train that was due here at 1600. The time is now 1900 hours, and you know what that means?
1900 hours. No, sir. My watch only goes up to 12.
It's 3 hours late, man. I'm supposed to pick up 2 customs officers. Can't you phone or something?
Oh, we got a letterbox, said Feely as he stuffed another sandwich into his mouth.
But is the train usually this late? Shouted the Major, becoming openly vituperative.
I myself have never timed it. Long as it goes backwards and forwards, that's all we care.
He coughed, showering the Major with pointillisms of bread and sardines.
You blasted idiot!
True, sir. Very true, said Feely, closing the partition.
Turning away in a fury, the Major fell heavily over a box. The darkness was filled with clucking chickens and swearing.
What bloody idiot left that crate there?
I did, said a nun.
This was all getting intolerable. Meanwhile, 4 miles up the line, showing no signs of life, was the 6:30 train for Pakoon.
I can't understand it. That coal bunker was full on Thursday.
Well, it's Friday and empty, said driver Murtagh.
Don't lose your temper, Murtagh. All we need is something to burn.
Oh, with a fine mind like that, you're wasting your time as a fireman. So you listen to me. We pass the cottage a few yards back. Go and see if they've got a couple of buckets of coal or peat.
Okay, said O'Malley, and he climbed down and crunched off into the darkness.
He continued on past the carriages, ignoring several catcalls, 2 empty bottles, and a passenger who couldn't hold it any longer. The cottage was dark save for a light in the back. There was no knocker, so with his hands in his pockets, he tapped with his foot.
Who's there?
Said a female voice.
Please, ma'am. It's the fireman from the Pakoon Flyer.
Did you fall off then?
Oh, no, ma'am. We run out of fuel.
The door opened. A girl's face appeared. It appeared very pretty, too.
Come in.
Oh, thanks.
The room was plain. A fire burnt in a large inglenook recess. A crucifix and a holy picture hung on a far wall, and a red light burned at a small altar.
And what is it you want?
Could we borrow a couple of buckets of coal or peat?
Coal I have, but would you like a cup of tea before you go? You look awful wet.
He shuffled his feet.
Oh, come on, she said, pushing him back into a chair. The train's never on time.
She kept looking at him in a way. He sipped his cup of tea. She was looking at him in that way again. He finished his cup of tea.
Oh, it's a wonder how one bed can take so much punishment. The springs groan under the combined assault of 2 activated bodies. It was an age-old story, but neither of them appeared to have heard it before.
From outside came an angry knocking on the door. From inside came an agonized coitus interruptus.
Oh, God, gasped O'Malley, rolling off. Who can it be?
How the hell did I know?
She was pulling on skirt, petticoat, stockings, but no drawers. After all, this could be a false alarm.
O'Malley wrestled frantically to tuck an unruly member into his trousers. Anybody in?
Relief showed in O'Malley's face.
It's all right. It's me, your mate.
Carrying the buckets of coal back up the line, O'Malley confided,
Hey, you know I was away so long.
Sure, I was watching you through the window. My God, you've got a spotty bum.
The train went, and Saturday came, and with it, payday.
Ha ha ha. Milligan rubbed his hands. 6 days grass cutting at 3 shillings a day. 6 multiplied by 3... 12 shillings.
He looked at the church clock. 4:32, time for lunch. The sun was warm again, and he stretched out on a gently sloping gravestone. He finished his meal at 4:32, just enough time for an hour's sleep. But the Milligan was awakened by the approach of an internal combustion engine.
The police. And the military.
He dived instinctively into a pile of cut grass. There was a tread of military boots up the drive. They stopped.
Anybody about? An English voice. What the hell were they doing back here?
Hello? Came the voice again. Through the lattice of grass he could see a corporal. He heard a soft gurgle as the soldier drained the last of Milligan's stout.
I'll get him for that, swore Milligan.
A second man approached. It was Major Stokes, and they were both joined by Sergeant McGillicuddy. Any signs of life, Corporal? A strange question in a graveyard.
No, sir. There must be somebody around her. I found this empty Guinness bottle.
Now, can I help you, gentlemen?
The voice of Father Rudden came on the scene.
Ah, Vicar! Vicar! The priest shuddered.
My name's Major Stokes, officer commanding the 2nd Ulster Rifles. He extended his hand, had it crushed, and returned.
And what can we do for you, Mr. Stokes?
We're here to build the new customs post and direct border fences.
I don't see how I can help. I've got a bad back, you know.
Major didn't seem to hear. He produced an ordnance survey map and pointed to a small red circle.
There, that is where it's to be.
The priest raised his eyebrows.
Customs shed? On church ground?
And we have instructions to start right away. Rudden rubbed his chin.
Very well. If it's the law, I can't stop it. But I think it's a damnable thing to run a frontier through a churchyard.
He stormed back to the church, ignoring the Major's attempts to explain.
Oh, he'll be all right, sir, said McGillicuddy with assurance. He's a fine man. He'll always give you a hand.
It'll be a long time before I give him mine again, said the Major, feeling for broken bones. Sunday came. Father Rudden clutched the pulpit. He had said mass at such a speed, the congregation were thrown into great confusion. Some were standing, others kneeling, some were leaving. The rest gave up and sat down. Skipping the sermon, he launched into a secular attack on the new border.
If that border is to be permanent, it means the holy Catholic departed will forever be lying in British soil out there.
And he pointed in the wrong direction. Sunday still, and 3 miles away, Dr. Goldstein pulled the sheet over the face of Dan Doonan. Mrs. Doonan took the news dry-eyed. She'd only stayed with him for the money. 20 years before, she had tried to get a separation. The solicitor listened to her attentively. But, Mrs. Doonan, just because you don't like him, that's no grounds for separation.
Well, make a few suggestions, he said.
Has he never struck you?
No, I'd kill him if he did.
Has he ever been cruel to the children?
Never.
Has he ever left you short of money, then?
No, every Friday on the nail.
I see.
Ah, wait. Think hard now, Mrs. Doonan. Has he ever been unfaithful to you?
Her face lit up. By God, I think we got him there. I know for sure he wasn't the father of my last child.
Now Dan was dead, and all the widow could wonder about was how much she'd be left in his will. But the family solicitors, pondering over the grey papers, discovered that Dan Doonan, at the age of 98, had died, leaving all his money to himself. Even the last paragraph of his will was clear. Doonan wanted £100 spent on a grand wake in honour of himself. Well, the inebriated chanting of professional mourners came wailing up from Doonan's house, and inside the front room, propped by the fireplace, was the flower-bedecked coffin of Doonan himself. Grouped around admiringly, reverently clutching their drinks, were friends and foes alike, and with drink they were all very much alike.
Ah, 'tis hard to believe he's dead.
Oh, he's dead, is he? Said Fogarty, who'd been speaking to him all evening.
O'Connor the Piper tucked his kilt between his legs, puffed the bladder of his pipes, and droned them into life. Soon the floor was lost in a sea of toiling, reeling legs. The faithful few in Dan's parlour soon deserted him for the dance. Alone in his room he stood, his body jerking to the rhythm, now shaking the house. The party was swelled by the arrival of the victorious Pacoon Hurley team, many still unconscious from the game. These were dutifully laid on the floor beside Dan's coffin. The rest joined in the frenzied dance. 3 fights had broken out in the midst of the dances, but the difference was hard to tell. The whole house now tremble from roof to foundations. In the next room, the great family Bible shook from the shelf above the coffin and struck Dan Doonan, throwing him from the coffin and catapulting him from his boots. His wig, a lifelong secret, shot from his head and slid under the table next to the cat. He fell among the unconscious members of the Hurley team, who were starting to recover.
He's drunk as a lord, they said,
dragging him across the hall and tucking him in bed. It was 4:32 in the morning. The last mourners had slobbered out their drunken farewells, their voices and great posterior blasts mingling in the night. Somewhere, a drunk Milligan was wandering through the braille black countryside. In his path, a well. Splash! It went on receipt of his body.
Help!
Shouted Milligan from the bottom of the well.
Help! Oh, help!
It echoed up.
Who's down there drinking me water?
A white face peered down the cool shaft. It was Farmer O'Mara.
It's me!
Dan? Dan? What are you doing down there?
I'm playing the cello. What do you think?
He threw Milligan a rope. Drying out by the fire, O'Mara gave him hot tea and whiskey. They awaited the morning. In the leaping firelight, Milligan saw O'Mara's face. His eyes were cups of sadness and seemed far, far older than him. A smile, thought Milligan, on that face would look like a sin. Milligan knew the story. O'Mara had married a raving beauty, Celia Kearns. The marriage had bore 3 children, Sean, Laura, and Sarah. It seemed perfect. Until O'Mara had caught her red-handed. The lover had fled across the countryside without his trousers, which was shown in evidence. O'Mara was awarded custody of the kids. That seemed the end of it. Things settled down, all but Celia, who was slowly going out of her mind. Losing the kids had done it. One night, Celia got into their bedroom and cut their throats. She was taken away and put in an asylum, and there she sat out her life, sitting and looking at a wall. Sitting and looking at a wall. Sitting and looking at a wall. For a man who'd laughed and loved life, O'Mara was cut down to a walking dead. Unknown to anybody, he still kept the children's beds made up, and every night slept with a teddy bear and a dolly clutched in his great hairy arms. Now he bred horses. In the spring, he'd watch the young rubber-legged foals racing to the sweet morning grass, and sometimes he thought he could see 3 laughing children on their backs. They lay buried in the churchyard of St. Teresa. He comforted himself with whiskey and an eternal hatred of women. "You drink too much," Dr. Goldstein told him. "I drink too much for what?" he asked in reply. The doctor, knowing his tragedy, stayed silent.
The funeral of Dan Doonan came treacle slow from the church. Benedictus Deus et Patri Domini Nomini Jesu Christi, Pater Misericordiam et Deum, chanted Father Rudden, walking on ahead. As long as he said something in Latin, they all thought they were getting value for money.
As a test, and under the influence of an overdose of whiskey, he had intoned the whole of a dirty story in Latin, which concluded with a solemn
Amen from the congregation.
They approached the new border customs post. From a hut, a buttoning his coat, came Barrington.
Good morning. A few formalities, sir, he said, thrusting the customs card at the priest. Read that, will you?
We have nothing to declare, sir. This is a funeral.
What have you got in the coffin?
You must be joking, said the priest, his face going purple with anger, and his anger going white with rage.
I'm not joking, sir, no. I'm merely doing my duty.
Very well. Inside the coffin is the body of 98-year-old Dan Doonan. Now let us pass.
We're not quite finished yet, sir. You intend to bury an Irish citizen in what is now British territory.
That is true.
The delay brought cries from the procession.
Hurry up! It's going to rain.
Get a move on before another of us passes on.
I've got bad legs, mister.
Barrington waited patiently and then continued.
I presume the deceased will be staying this side permanently.
Unless someone invents a remarkable drug, yes.
Then, went on Barrington, you require the following. An Irish passport stamped with a visa to be renewed annually for the rest of his... Barrington almost said life. stay, he concluded. Everyone was seeing red, except Fogarty, who was colourblind. The priest's dark eyes were fixed on the composed face of his tormentor. Vengeance belongs to God, he thought, but this fellow belongs to me.
Take him back to the church, lads. We'll have to postpone the burial.
Inside his box, dear Dan Doonan was above it all. Arthur Manuel Fadigan, famed Pakoon photographer, hummed the Rose of Tralee, screwed the top back on his pile ointment, and pulled up his trousers. His small green shop bell tinkled briefly, and in came three men with the dangling Dan Doonan.
Is he drunk? Inquired Mr. Fadigan.
No, said one of Dan's supporters. He's got leg trouble.
Then what's his head hanging down for?
Well, he's got leg trouble that goes right away up to his neck.
Oh, well, just sit him in the chair.
Doonan slid to the floor.
Up's a daisy, said Fadigan kindly.
Can you give him a passport photo?
Why, is he going away?
Yes.
And where to?
Oh, we're not sure. He's, got a choice of two places.
Okay, then. So just hold him like that in a minute. Smile! There, that's it. Now, if he's pleased with the result, perhaps he'll come again.
Oh, he'll never be pleased as that, said the departing trio.
Autumn laid a russet hand over the county. The great summer trees cried their leaves to the ground.
Thank God the grass has stopped growing, said Milligan,
as he greased the scythes for their long winter hibernation. But peace was not his for long.
Hello there!
Milligan looked to the voice. It was the black-coated Fogarty, wandering aimlessly along outside the church wall, eating an unpeeled banana.
I'm on my way to the meeting. Will you come in?
The meeting? Good God, I forgot.
Milligan rushed into his overcoat and made quickly for the church hall on his bike, Fogarty running alongside.
Why are you holding your head, Milligan?
I've got a headache.
Oh, then don't come near me, then. I don't want to catch it.
The corrugated iron roof of the Pakoon Church Hall reverberated to the angry shouts within.
We're not going to put up with this, said Mrs. O'Brien. Every time I want to visit me father's grave, I have to be searched by a customs man, and he's got cold hands. On top of that, I've got to show a passport of myself.
Down she sat, up she stood.
It's a disgrace.
Up she stood, down she sat.
I've had enough of it.
She whacked her umbrella down flush on the head of Mrs. Ellis. Up she stood.
Oh,
she screamed. Down sat Mrs. O'Brien, and up stood Father Rudden, waving a calming hand.
Steady now, steady now. I know how you feel, but can we please continue with further complaints in relation to the new frontier?
Yes. Mr. O'Toole jumped to his feet. This boundary affects me terribly. Me pub is all in this side of the border, all except 2 square feet in the far corner of the public bar.
Is that a hardship?
Is it? That 2 square feet is an Ulster, where the price of drinks is 30% cheaper. Now every night, me pub is empty, save for a crowd of bloody skinflints, all huddled in the corner like Scrooges.
Father Rodden promised a solution and closed the meeting. A lemon peel moon rose into the cold sky. Milligan whistled.
That's a nice tune, said Rafferty.
Well, it's part of the Eroica Symphony. I wrote it.
You wrote the Eroica?
Yes.
What about Beethoven?
Yes, I wrote that as well.
You're a bloody liar.
Cheerfully he whistled his next composition, Grieg's A Minor Concerto by Milligan, in C. Life wasn't too bad. Suddenly, Rafferty went tense.
I think we're on the wrong road, Milligan.
Why do you say that? We've just passed a Chinaman.
We couldn't have come that far.
I'm not joking. It was a Chinee, I tell you. Not only that, he was wearing a police hat.
We never had that much to drink, did we?
They argued their way into the beckoning night. From the roadside, Constable Lee Arpong made a note of 2 drunken men arguing on a bike. He looked at his watch and then added the time to his report, then waxed mysterious and disappeared sideways into the night. Mr. Arpong of Peking, China, had arrived in Dublin on a tramp steamer, the General Gordon. The little Chinese had done this trip to escape the stark poverty of China and was soon happily walking into the stark poverty of Ireland. He had jumped ship in Dublin with his worldly fortune of £12 in yens,
It took a Dublin bank clerk 18 hours and 2 mental breakdowns to work out the exchange.
Ah Pong came out with a smile and asked the first stranger, "Hello. Hello, General Gordon. Where are Chinatown?"
Not having one, the Dubliner thought the next best thing would be the Jewish quarter. So he took Ah Pong to Frog Street and pointed to a sign, "Bed and breakfast for hire." A large woman opened a small door.
"You want a room?" said Mrs. Goldberg. "Please. I not make English much. Hello. I come like of Peking. Oh, hello, General Gordon, me." "I don't know what he's saying," she shouted back down the passage. "I think it's General Gordon."
"What is it?" Mr. Goldberg came blinking, shuffling up the corridor. "Oh," he saw Ah Pong. "Whoa, he's all right. He's a foreigner. I mean, they eat anything. Come in, come in." He made a friendly gesture with the Dublin Jewish Chronicle.
Chinese.
You're Chinese? Well, well, we live and learn.
"A cup of tea, Mr. Chinese?"
asked Mrs. Goldberg, removing the cost.
Ah Pong made a sign in mime that he wished a bed for the night, lying on the floor and placing his hands along his head.
"See that racial," said the enlightened Mr. Goldberg. "Chinese drink it lying down." A puzzled Chinese watched as both Goldbergs took tea stretched on the floor. Lodgers were hard to come by and at all cost to be encouraged. A true son of the Orient, Ah Pong carried his customs with him. The Chinese New Year came up.
"Happy New Year," he shouted to a tram full of puzzled Dubliners and was bodily hurled off.
For weeks he had searched for employment. His little store of money soon dwindled. One day he told the Goldbergs,
"Hello, goodbye. Me, I, money, all gone. No work here for Chinese. I bugger off, General Gordon."
The Goldbergs had grown very fond of the little man. He paid his rent on the dot, and he didn't mind chickens in his bedroom. Mr. Goldberg remembered the New Republic were desperately short of policemen. They had advertised the fact in the paper. "Men of good physique, over 4 feet 3 inches, will find a good life in the new Irish Free State Police Force." Inspector Gogarty Muldoon was hard put to it. He parried it at a pencil on his desk. "A Chinee," he kept muttering and looking out the window. "A Chinee. God knows we need recruits. But a Chinee."
He's a nice little fellow, sir," said Sergeant Behan.
"Nice, yes, Behan. But consider the prospect. If Ah Pong becomes the constable here, he's bound to succeed, as the Chinese are very clever. In 10 years from now, the entire police force of Ireland could be Chinese."
"Including me?" asked the worried sergeant.
The inspector didn't bother to reply. At 4:32 on the stroke of midnight, 7 dedicated men sat around a table in the vestry of the Church of St. Teresa.
"Men," began Father Rodden, "I think you all know why we are here."
They nodded their heads. Some grunted, and Milligan said yes.
"Good. The trouble is this. 3 people from Pocoon have to go through that customs gate to see their departed. Those are the graves of," he read from a small line of paper, "Patrick Grogan, Harold Olins, and Dan Doonan. God rest their souls. So, unpleasant as I find it, I feel obliged to remove their bodies from that side for reburial over here. Now, this can only be achieved by asking their permission," he pointed towards the customs, "which I resent. Or we could bring them back secretly under cover of darkness, and I favor the latter."
"Oh, which is the latter, Father?" said Milligan.
The brass stair of the oil lamp suffused the room. The faces of the plotters bathed yellow in the tallow light. The priest outlined his plan and swore them all to secrecy.
"Before you go, let's drink a toast."
He took a bottle of unblessed communion wine from the cupboard.
"Bojalis, 1920, a good year."
"It'll be a better year when you open it, Father."
"Patience, Milligan, patience."
Patience, thought Milligan. That word was invented by dull buggers who couldn't think quick enough.
"Now then, wine must be treated with respect." So saying, he shook the bottle violently. "Mix all the goodness in," he said gleefully. "Wine," the priest was saying, "is liquid Christianity. There was never a bigger argument against teetotalers than the miracle at Cana." 5 glasses clinked. "Schlader!" they chorused. They all drank. They drank again. Then several more agains. Then a series of agains, followed by 1 long permanent again. Father Rudden was starting to rock unsteadily. Laughter was coming more frequent, and with it, occasional song.
Father Rodden was busy finding yet another bottle of wine.
Ah, before I open this one, I want to make an appeal. We are in need of fighting funds to help us with accessories. I should, pardon me, I should like to start by asking for donations right now.
There was a grim, long, embarrassing silence.
Oh, come, come, no. I'm not asking for hundreds of pounds. Just a little to start with. Would somebody say 10 shillings?
I can say it, Father, said Milligan, but I haven't got it.
I've got it, thought Goldstein, but I'm not going to say it.
O'Brien opened his wallet and without a word spread 3 1-pound notes onto the table in front of the priest.
There, Father, that's for the lot of us. I had a good win at the races today.
With his hand shaking and silenced by the vastness of the amount, the father picked up the money.
God bless you.
O'Brien,
oh, this will cover everything.
The glasses clinked again. The light from the lamp shone through the wine, and the ceiling was dancing with leaping red rubies from below.
This will have to be the last one. It's early mass tomorrow. So,
said the priest as he drained his glass. Made the sign of the cross and fell backwards into the dock.
Oh, the poor man's tired, said O'Mara, picking the priest up and carefully placing him on the bed.
Milligan removed the priest's shoes.
Good God, if I had that many holes in me socks, I'd use them as mittens.
Julio Caesar presents the world's finest animal circus. The words were painted 6 foot high in modest black and white. Circus master Julio Caesar, king of the ring, was a worried man. He was constantly at war with fleas that continually transfer their allegiance from his monkeys to him. At midnight he awoke scratching and cussing when through his caravan window he made the awful discovery. The cage was open and the beast was gone. Scratching with one hand and dialing with the other, he phoned the vet. Awaking from his veterinary slumbers, Mr. Retch groped in the dark for the jangling instrument.
Hello, this is Julius Caesar. Could I speak with your husband?
Oh, this is me husband speaking, said Mr. Retch.
Good. One of my black panthers, he make escape.
Mr. Retch gulped himself into consciousness.
I'll meet you outside the police station right away in 10 minutes' time.
Hurriedly, Mr. Retch pocketed a humane killer, a phial of liquid and a hypodermic, then stepped into his trousers and into the night. Back in the wood, along the riverbank, stumbled 5 happy drunks. One of them, Rafferty, stopped.
Shh! There's something in me trap.
The information silenced the singing. Cautiously they approached a black, sleek shape crouching on the ground.
It's a...
commenced Rafferty, but was cut short by a scarlet mouth emitting an unusually loud growl.
No, it isn't. It isn't what?
Queried O'Brien.
It isn't what I thought it was at first.
The creature repeated a growl loud enough to stop the 5 in their tracks. What it was, they knew not. That it was very big, they knew. But what type of very big, they also knew not.
I don't think it's a goat, Milligan said.
You're right, agreed Dr. Goldstein. It's the wrong noise for a goat. If it was a goat, it would go...
Bah! For God's sake, keep quiet, Doctor,
said Rafferty, who for the first time in his poaching life was puzzled.
Bah!
Continued Goldstein. Kneeling on all fours, he charged O'Brien's unsuspecting seat. There was an inky black pause and a great splash.
You bloody Jewish idiot,
said O'Brien, wallowing, groping, stumbling, falling in the shallow river waters.
Give it your hand,
said O'Mara, pulling the soggy O'Brien to the bank.
Feel if there's any fish in his pockets, said Milligan, holding his stomach with laughter.
I'll get you for this, Goldstein.
They were all silenced by a low, almost evil snarl from the beast. Rafferty took a coil of rope from his sack.
Here, little animal, he said, advancing cautiously.
The reply was a stomach-loosening roar. Rafferty beckoned them all towards the beast.
I'll get the noose over his neck. Then everyone take one leg each.
They advanced unsteadily.
Puss, puss, puss,
said Milligan, holding out his hand.
You're right, Milligan. It's a cat, a black cat. Gad, he's had a good feed. Just look at the size of him. The animal sprang, uprooting the trap, hitting O'Mara in the chest.
Omar the giant leapt to his feet. No bloody pussycat's gonna do that to me. He lashed out, struck the animal a pole-axe blow, and the panther sank into unconsciousness.
The five split up. Omar paused only once on the way to throw a struggling panther into the charge room of the police station. There followed a series of screams, growls, ripping noises, then came a shattering of glass as the night constable came hurtling to the window and ran up the road. A recently lacerated constable, with a finely shredded seat to his trousers, addressed Mr. Julio Caesar.
Have you lost a black panther, sir? 'Cause I have reason to suspect I have made contact with that animal.
In the 6 months from recruitment, Ah Pong had picked up an amount of the language and could write a report on simple Irish crime, like murder, rape, etc. Kitted out in blue, he was given a warrant and entrained to Pakoon. Passing the police station one day, Rafferty had dropped in to see if there were any current warrants out for his arrest.
"Good morning, Sarge."
Ah Pong turned. "Please," he said, and the little Chinaman advanced towards Rafferty.
"No, don't come near me, McGillicuddy. I don't want to catch that."
"Please, what is the trouble?"
"I was right," thought Rafferty. "That was a Chinese I saw the other night."
"Where's Sergeant McGillicuddy?" he asked. "Does he know you're wearing his uniform?"
"Please understand. I real police. My name, Ah Pong."
"You's a real police?"
Rafferty paused, his lips pursed. His face took on a cunning look.
"Here, do you's know the meaning of the word poacher?" "Sorry, me or no understand."
Rafferty's face burst into a smile. "Me and yous is going to get on real fine." He shook the smiling Chinaman's hand and departed. Ah Pong opened a Chinese-English dictionary and ran his finger down the P's. P-O-A-C-H-E-R. Ah. He made a swift note in Pekingese, and very soon Rafferty was to know the meaning of the word inscrutable. Just out of town, in a deserted barn, two little men with the arse out of their trousers were holding a mass meeting. They had both known better days, but not partaken in them. They were forced to admit that the glorious days of the IRA were in decline.
"Comrades," said Seamus Ford, addressing his partner from a chair, "I have good tidings. This new customs post at Pakoon is a boon and a blessing to men. Now I have me plan." Seamus went on with great fire. "To bury stiffs these days, they've got to take them through that new customs post. It's a gift from heaven, don't you see?"
"No, I don't see, Seamus," said Lenny Braddock, the mass meeting.
"Well, pay attention then. Give us the puff on your fag. Ta. Now, our contracts on the other side says that they're short of explosives, right?"
"Right."
"Well, normally, without the convenience of a coffin, you'd have to have your luggage searched and your pockets."
"That's true, that's true. Can I have me fag back?"
"Now," ignored Seamus, "if we could get a coffin and rig up a phony burial, we could carry enough Gaelic night stuff in that coffin to force Ulster back into the Republic, don't you see?"
"Gar, by gar, that is a fine plan, boyo, a fine plan. I think this is the turning point in the history of Ireland. Now, can I have me fag back?"
"Now, what we needs is a coffin. Have you got them counterfeit pound notes?"
"Yes, but can I have me fag back first?"
Life is a long, agonized illness, only curable by death. Reuben Croucher lovingly and delicately dusted the coffins displayed in his parlor. They were such beautiful things. Stately box that bore us across the river Styx into the eternal life beyond. All was peace and calm within. The only sound was the endless buzzing of a lone fly who shall remain nameless. Reuben Croucher walked with crane-like dignity across the black cracking lino to the window. His long, thin nose pointed the way, while a million rivers of tiny ruptured veins suffused his cadaverous face. Two watery eyes like fresh cracked eggs in lard looked out from a skull-like head. It had got dark early, and he had lit the gas, which cast a sepulchral glow along the neatly arranged coffins. With a cloth, he wiped the condensation from the sightless windows. Business was bad. It seemed people couldn't afford to die these days. But what was this? Two ragged-ass men were approaching, both smoking the same cigarette. They were pulling a cart and heading rapidly for the shop. Pausing only to open the door, they entered. When Lenny saw the face of Mr. Croucher, he reverently took his hat off. Croucher bowed ever so slightly from the waist up.
"Good morning," he said, and then after some thought added, "Gentlemen." After all, they could be eccentric millionaires. Seamus coughed.
"We're eccentric millionaires. Now, do you sell coffins?"
Mr. Croucher nodded.
"Yes, we do, sir. And as a try-on, and how many do you want?"
"I just the one to start with," said Seamus, the executive.
"Good, good. And who is the deceased?"
Seamus hadn't thought of this, but he was a man of some guile.
"Oh, it's for me friend here." And he pointed at Lenny.
"You see, he hasn't been well lately, and we thought just to be on the safe side, we'd have one now."
Mr. Croucher indicated the coffins. Seamus and Lenny ran their hands over several.
We'll have that one."
"Ah, a black one. A very wise choice, sir. It won't show the dirt."
Mr. Croucher withheld a whimper of joy. It was the most expensive coffin in the shop.
Lenny slid over the side and lay back in the pink satin padding.
"Oh, it's real fine. This is really worth dying for."
He squirmed to make himself more comfortable.
"Now let's try the lid on," said Mr. Croucher.
Carefully he lowered the lid over little Lenny's white face.
"How's that feel, Lenny?"
"Oh, very nice. Very, very nice."
"Right," said Seamus, addressing Mr. Croucher. "We'll have this one." In a small room at the back, Mr. Croucher slid behind an order book and perched on a fountain pen. His black tail coat hung from his shoulders like tired wings. Neatly, he took down details in his book. All was silent, save the scratch of his nib on ruled foolscap.
"There's your receipt, sir," said Mr. Croucher, after carefully counting and recounting 38 carefully forged pound notes.
That night, he lay abed, cooing through his shrunken gums.
"A 38-pound coffin sale. Bless us and thank thee, O Lord, for the merciful benefits thou bestowest on us."
He crossed himself on his homemade prayer, turned slowly onto his side, and fell into a deep, peaceful 38-pound dream. At 3 o'clock in the morning, he died in his sleep. The cost of his funeral came to exactly 38 pounds. His puzzled wife, even now, was in the county jail for passing forged currency. Autumn, season of mists and mellow fruitfulness.
"That's a lot of rot," said Milligan, examining his fingers for frostbite.
He scraped the jigsaw of leaves into little funeral pyres, stooped to light one, and warmed his hands. The shrill, elastic whistle of a robin came clear through the misty morning.
"Ah, shut up, you idiot!"
Milligan was in no mood for nature. His wages were 2 weeks overdue, and his wife was three.
I say, Paddy."
It was an English voice. Milligan looked up. Webster was outside the customs tent, beckoning him.
"Me name's not Paddy."
He hated Englishmen who called Irishmen Paddy.
"Would you like a cup of tea, Paddy?"
Paddy Milligan dropped his rake and arrived before it hit the ground.
It's the first time I had tea with the customs."
"Would you like a dash of whiskey in it?" said Webster.
"Well, I'll accept that, sir."
"Say when."
"I will not."
"I found this bottle on a morn at Dan Doonan's funeral."
"Oh, well, some of them needs it, especially the bereaved. I knew a fella, so bereaved he could hardly stand."
In the face of such hospitality, Milligan felt a twinge of conscience just below the knee. For the last 3 weeks, they had let him through the border without even searching him. In return, he had spent his time loosening the earth around Dan Doonan's grave in preparation for the great event. All that remained now was for Father Rudden to give the word. Father Rudden was already to give the word, but for the unexpected arrival of two ragged-ass men, both smoking the same cigarette and pushing a coffin. Strange, he had not been notified of a funeral.
"Please, Father," said Seamus, "we are poor illiterate farmers. We can't read, write, or post letters. And we have pushed this coffin of our grandmother 100 miles for this burial, and we would be glad if you would officiate."
Father Rudden was about to refuse when Seamus produced a wad of pound notes.
"Father, we would like to donate this to the church." Before Seamus had finished, the priest, never taking his eyes off the money, sprinted backwards to the vestry and returned fully robed with a collection plate and the book open at the service.
1 hour later, the customs were examining the beautifully forged passport of the late Mrs. Eileen Ford. There followed a solemn burial of 280 pounds of TNT. Amen.
The heavy metal cutters minced through the barbed wire. O'Brien had cut close to the wooden posts. Father Rodden at his side gave the thumbs-up sign. Through the gap, the five men crawled towards the grave of Dan Doonan, rapidly becoming the most travelled corpse in Ireland. Milligan cast anxious eyes towards the sentry, 300 yards to their left. A light from the guard hut glinted on the soldier's bayonet. The five men moved to the temporary shelter of an ancient mulberry. Mind you, only 1 hour before, two ragged-ass men smoking the same cigarette had hid in the self-same place. They, too, had felt for the grave of the loose earth. And soon, they were digging up the coffin of Dan Doonan.
Strange. This TNT doesn't feel so heavy now.
No, no, it doesn't, said Lenny, struggling manfully alone under the weight of the coffin.
Father Rodden led his men forward. His hand, too, now felt for the grave with the loose earth.
It's funny. I could have sworn it was over there, said Milligan as the shovel set to work.
Soon the coffin of Mrs. Eileen Ford, with its 200 pounds of TNT, was rising.
Freeze, said Goldstein.
The party stood, knelt, and lay transfixed as a soldier came suspiciously forward. He held his rifle at the ready. He came closer. He stopped, looked cautiously left and right, placed his rifle against a tree.
That dirty swine! No wonder this place is starting to smell.
They heaved on the ropes. Sweat was pouring down Milligan's arms.
Freeze! The bloody sentry was coming back. The diggers, gasping, lay flat and still, their ropes cutting their hands.
Anybody out there? If there's anybody out there, say so, and I will fire.
Silence. The soldier about turned and marched away. With relief, O'Mara put his great shoulders to the rope and pulled the coffin towards the church.
God, he's heavier since he died. It must suit him.
Ah Pong lay lynx-like and silent in a tree of his own choosing. He was about to descend when two shadowy, ragged-assed figures, carrying another box, headed in the opposite direction. Seamus and Lenny heard a sneeze above them and were hit by a barefooted falling Chinaman. Running with a coffin cart, they disappeared, firing their pistols in all directions. Ah Pong replied with a burst of whistleblowing, took a pace backwards, and disappeared into an empty grave. The guard turned out and opened fire.
The IRA!
Went up the cry. A bewildered bugler in underpants blew lights out and put the whole camp in darkness. Incendiary bullets crisscrossed the night sky. Veil lights burst in the darkness. Private Dawson saw a Chinese arising from a grave and promptly did in his trousers what Cascara takes 24 hours to do.
Halt! Who goes there? He said, hurriedly tearing up a newspaper.
Quaking with fear, the Chinese answered in Pekingese and was immediately fired at in Gaelic. Hysterically, he ran chattering into the night.
Sod that for a lark!
Ah Pong was really getting a grip on the language. It was 4:32. The firing had died away. There was now an uneasy silence. Then, from the distance, came the unmistakable sound of an unidentified noise.
Hello!
The voice was strange to them, but not to Fogarty. The corporal made a signal to his man.
This might be a trick, so hold your fire till I give 3 short blasts and a whistle.
Hello!
It was coming closer. Still running, Arpong tripped over Milligan's shovel. Heroically, he blew 3 blasts on his whistle, and Fogarty received the full ballistic weight of B Company's firepower. The moon came out, its silver beams streaming through the bullet holes in Fogarty's trousers and hat. Life is a matter of majorities. Either you have one or you haven't. Right now, Fogarty was outvoted. The dawn came up like thunder out of China across the bay. It didn't do that in Ulster. Shivering and swearing, Lenny and Seamus scraped the hoar frost from their faces and pushed Dan Doonan's coffin into the bushes.
We can't hang around here, Lenny. They'd be looking for us on both sides now. What bloody bad luck. We'll have to leave this TNT till the hoo-ha dies down.
The sound of a bugle broke the morning silence. Lenny hid behind Seamus.
Is that the military? I don't know. It come from over there.
The two men climbed to the lip of a hill and peered cautiously over. A fine sight met their eyes, gleaming white in the morning sun were the tents of that nobly neat society, the Boy Scouts. This was the Ulster annual jamboree. For weeks past, hundreds of spotty-faced Herberts with yodeling voices and chin fuzz had tied 3 million knots, started 10,000 twig fires, and completed 600 leaf shelters,
Perfect training for round about 3000 BC, but bloody useless in the 20th century. Seamus could just read the sign. Scout store, re-kitten section. Scouts of all sizes were lining up for a fine breakfast of burnt eggs and carbonized toast when two ragged-ass men slipped unnoticed under the flaps of a marquee. Two brand-new scouts re-emerged in ill-fitting uniforms and enjoyed the pleasure of an al fresco breakfast without payment.
Ho-ho! This is a stroke of luck. No one but Baden Powell would think of looking for us here.
Seamus nodded in agreement, his mouth moving relentlessly on a slice of dead pig recumbent on a sea of porridge.
"Pardon me, sir," said a small scout sitting opposite, his face held together with pimples. "What trip are you from?"
"A deterred to Puckoon Rangers," said Seamus, licking his lips, plate, knife, fork, spoon, fingers and thumbs. 12 miles north of Puckoon, set in rolling acres, rose the delicate Georgian facades of Brent Lodge, built in an age when craftsmen loved the excitement of creation, be it only brick upon brick. Now it lay open to its greatest enemy, the 20th century. In the hands of the local council, it had been reduced to units of housing. The youngest member of this aging community was ex-variety artist Patrick L. Balls. He had once whistled Ave Maria for Queen Victoria. She wasn't present at the time, but nevertheless, that's who he was whistling it for. But today would be very busy. No whistling for him. Today was the concert. Once a year, the scouts came and did a concert of talking. Tonight, they would perform in the Hydro Hall a drastically cut version of the immortal bard Julius Caesar. The indoor plunge bath in the Hydra was boarded over, and the great French windows were folded back to make way for the temporary stage that backed onto the garden. Behind this was the 1909 Didion motor car, whose yellow wheels drove the power for the footlights. Slowly now, the hall was filling with the spectre-like audience. The sisters, Agnes and Millicent Grope, walked mincingly down the aisle on Minnie Mouse legs, fox furs around their long, thin white necks.
"It's Julius Caesar again," said Agnes, taking her seat. "Oh, it was Julius Caesar last year, Agnes. Oh, I suppose this is an encore."
Preparing themselves in the orchestra pit were the Patrick Ferg Refined Trio, a doddering trinity of febrile musicians led by a bent, thin violinist. Suddenly, a small, hastily made-up, roseate face appeared from the wings.
"Psst! Ready in minutes!"
Both conversation and the house lights went down. A few exhibition coughers voiced their bronchial ego. The silence that followed was shattered by two loud thumps of Patrick Ferg's boots, and the refined trio launched shakily into several bars of obscure music.
"Good God," said a music lover finally, it's William Tell."
Slowly the front curtain rose rapidly, stuck and crashed down again. It rose rapidly, got stuck and stayed stuck rapidly. It revealed a forest of anonymous legs. Two embarrassed scoutmasters, with overcoats hastily donned over togas, shuffled onto the stage. The program note said Rome, the steps of the Imperial Palace. My, how the old place had changed. Standing on this noble pile, the figure of an 8-year-old Cassius was speaking. Proud and erect he stood, in his white bedsheet and cardboard laurel leaves, in his pocket a complete set of great footballers' cigarette cards. To the refined ear, trained for euphony, Shakespeare rings most comforting. To a Roman spearman named Seamus Ford, it brought a mental remark.
What in the hell is this all about?
Cassius raised his hands to silence the mob. The great curtain crashed to the stage. From the rear came another crash, a metallic clang. The silencer had fallen from the generator car, and the ensuing noise of the opening exhaust forced the young actors to shout, causing one Roman's nose to bleed. A change of wind was now blowing smoke from the long carbonized car engine up to the cracks in the stage. The cast were now reduced to shouting and coughing. The smoke gradually obscured the players, who all moved forward to the footlights. Unaffected, the Ferg trio were playing in the Hall of the Mountain King. The smoke had caused a disturbed deaf member of the audience to phone the fire brigade.
"Come quick! Brent Lodge is in flames! Thousands are trapped!" was the simple message.
In the front row was a guest of honour, Inspector Tomalty. For 10 minutes he had been wrestling with the face of a certain Roman soldier. Suddenly, he clicked his fingers. Seamus Ford.
Soon two black mariahs thundered in the night, during which time the audience were treated to the spectacle of 6 men in brass helmets dashing on a smoke-filled stage with hoses. They immediately set about the floor with hatchets, and with the first stroke, 3 toes came off. Smoke now obscured the entire cast from the audience. Groping forward, a fat Julius Caesar tripped and fell onto the piano. With a splintering groan, the Patrick Ferg refined trio, all playing valiantly, slid majestically into the warm waters of the hydro pool below. A chain reaction followed as the temporary floor broke into sections. Everywhere were floating rafts bearing the trapped, shouting, aged audience. Hoses were starting to douse the remaining actors. Police whistles announced new arrivals. Shouts of help came from the marooned audience.
Let's beat it, said Seamus, pulling Lenny with him. They reached the first floor with the police at their heels. The lift, a gift from above.
Slamming the gates, Seamus gave the ancient rope the pull of its rotting life. It snapped. The ancient lift hurtled down the shaft, hit the rubber buffers in the basement, and hurtled up again. It hovered at the third floor, twixt momentum and gravity, just long enough for an unsuspecting chambermaid to step in and hurtle down again.
Oh, have we got the electric on? She smiled at the terrified occupants.
Patrick Balls, not wanting to spend his remaining years yo-yoing in a lift, grabbed at the end of the frayed rope as it came within reach and was left hanging as the lift hurtled down again. Rocketing up, Seamus and Lenny judged the pause and leaped out at the second floor. Cries of, "Send help!" came from the plummeting gentlefolk. Colonel Carrington Thark, retired, awoke from his slumbers, heard the cacophony, and leaped from his bed. Sabre in hand, he opened the door and fell right over a fire hose. "Take that, you swine!" he yelled, slicing through the pulsating canvas. Meanwhile, the brigade were being severely hampered by 2 things, a lack of water and a lack of fire. Frantically lighting fires as he went, Fire Chief Muldoon discovered a rusty verdigris board covered in turncocks. "Hallelujah!" he exclaimed as he turned the lot on. There came a rumbling sound from the bowels of the earth. Long-forgotten fountains lived again. Eroded pipes burst in all directions. Streams of water shot from under many an unsuspecting victim. 30 great jets hurled a screaming scoutmaster 20 feet in the air, ripping his boots and socks from his feet. Once gentle B-days suddenly gushed up unsuspecting old females, giving them a mixed feeling of fear and joy. Old Admiral Munro, under his shower, was flattened by the increase in water power. He took to his heels, running naked into the corridor, falling right onto a tea tray outside his door. Seated on it like an aged puck, he slid powerless down the steps and finally shot out the front door onto the lawn at the feet of Mrs. Grimblesnack. "Madam," roared the quick-witted admiral, "get out of my bathroom!" But she would have none of his finesse.
"If you don't go to my bedroom at once, I'll scream."
He fled into the countryside and later was found dead from indecent exposure. In the vestry of the Church of St. Teresa came the conspiratorial whisper of Father Rudden talking rapidly to the Milligan. Father placed one hand on Milligan's shoulder.
"We'll rebury him tonight in Holy Catholic Island," said the priest, his voice full of pride and achievement. "You realize that we've only got 2 more dear souls to bring back, and we've won!" He waved his hands aloft like battle flags. "People will point to you in the street, Milligan," signaled the father.
"But they do that already."
"Ah, but this will be different. You'll be a hero. There he goes, they will say. Or, here he comes, according to the direction you're traveling, you understand. And on top of that, if the Pope gets to hear this, you could be made a papal knight."
"Me, a papal knight?" Milligan screwed up his eyes to get a better vision of himself, walking up the steps of the Vatican. "How are you there, Milligan, me boy?" the Pope would say. "I'm fine, Your Honor." "My, my, Milligan, you've done a fine job of work digging up them stiffs and bringing them back to consecrated ground." And Milligan would smile. "Well, Your Honor," he'd say, "anything for the old church." Then the trumpets would blare out Danny Boy by Cellini, and the Pope would give him a certificate, 2 pounds, and a bottle of holy water. "Arise, fair papal knight, the Milligan." "All right, Father Rudden, I'll do it."
"And remember, Milligan," the priest said,
a look of profound wisdom on his face. There's an old Irish saying. He paused, his eyes closed as though searching his soul. Milligan stood quietly and patiently by. Finally, the priest opened his eyes. I can't quite remember it at the moment, he concluded. Outside the gardener's hut, Milligan paused to light his pipe. A hairy arm reached out from the shed and laced around his throat, dragging him back.
This is a gun in your back, hissed a hoarse voice.
All right, gasped Milligan. As long as you don't shoot, I can stand it.
The arm uncurled. He turned to see Seamus Ford. Look lively, said the gunman. Take your clothes off. Hurry! The pistol's blue mouth was directed at Milligan's heart. Slowly, Milligan removed his trousers, not without a feeling of apprehension. Now listen, Death. There's a limit to what I'll do. Milligan wondered if this strange metal-clad figure was one of those homosexual murders that were so popular in better-educated countries. Naked, save for his socks, Milligan was told to stand in the corner of the hut with his hands above his head. Now, said the voice, you'll stay facing that way. The door closed behind him, the outside bolt went home, and he heard the gunman's horse gallop away. Snow was starting to fall. It was very, very cold. Milligan lit the stove and started to shout for help. Next to the stove, the coffin started to singe. Walking up the church drive with mathematical precision came the county surveyor, Mr. Morris Prells. He had the white blotting paper complexion of a man who worked undercover and slept with the windows closed. Mr. Prells calculated that at that very moment his age was 47 years, 3 months, 2 days, 10 hours and 40 minutes. His weight, with the grey suit, was 168 pounds, 3 ounces. Life was a precise affair. At this very moment, if anyone were to ask him the precise weight of the sewage discharged by Pakoon, he could answer down to the fine ounce. At parties, even when not asked, he would give this precise figure. One must have facts and figures. His little meek wife, walking on an invisible chain at his side, was a fact and a figure. In fact, at 18, she had been a very good figure, but now the years were rapidly altering her statistics. Together, they were strolling up the church drive towards evening devotions. He gauged his stride as 2 feet 9 inches, and each foot would weigh roughly a pound. Suddenly, his calculations were interrupted. Psst! Mr. Prell stopped. Psst! It appeared to be coming from inside the garden shed. There must be someone in residence, thought Mr. Prells. Smoke was coming from the chimney. Mr. Prells leaned towards the door and spoke. Who's in there going pussed?
Me name's Milligan. Dan Milligan.
Oh, I'm very pleased to meet you, said Prells through the keyhole and raised his hat. My name is Mr. Prells, and this here is my wife Kitty. So saying, he slid one of his business cards under the door.
Never mind all that. Unbolt the door. 'Tis a matter of life and death.
Deftly, Mr. Prells withdrew the bolt, assessing it to be about 2 pounds in weight. The door opened slowly, and there stood Milligan, the Roman soldier, which, Mr. Prells assessed, was about 2,000 years out of date. Before he could explain, there was a crunch of Ulster police boots on gravel.
"That's the feller!" shouted the sergeant.
In a moment, Milligan went under to a sea of flailing truncheons and snapping handcuffs.
"Help! Stop screaming! Oh! Stop! Stop! Oh! I surrender! Not till we finish, you don't! Oh!"
Through the blue serge legs, Milligan saw a small tent of blue that the prisoner called the sky. He took it. Up the road he ran, his left wrist handcuffed to his right ankle. Rocks bounced off his skull. The police were gaining. Proof positive, thought Mr. Prells, that 5 pairs of legs are faster than one. "What's going on here?" said Father Rudden, issuing from the vestry, his face covered in shaving soap. "What are you doing in my churchyard?" he roared, pulling off a layer of policemen.
"This man is a member of the IRA, sir," they said, pointing at Milligan.
"Nonsense. This man is my gardener."
"Then your gardener is a member of the IRA," they said, dragging Milligan away.
"Stop! Stop!" said the priest. "Gentlemen," he said, in tones most contrite, but continuing to shave, "if you'll just step into the vestry, I'll admit the entire plot to capture the Queen of England." The sergeant dropped his truncheon with shock.
This was a turn-up for the book. Very well. First, I'll want a signed confession.
The priest stood to one side. He was not numerically equipped to stand more.
In here, gentlemen, he said.
One by one, the police filed into the vestry. The door slammed behind them.
Run for the police and the militia!
They heard him shout to Milligan. The trapped men were hammering on the inside of the door, and nails started to fly out like confetti. The priest continued to shave as fast as he could. In the gardener's hut, the wood of the coffin was starting to smoulder. The wind blew bitter cold. It was 24 hours since the panther escaped. Mr. Retch and Julius Caesar looked miserably at each other. The creature must have crossed the border. The cage pulled up at the customs post. Wearily, Julio let himself to the ground and approached the sentry. "Pardon me," said the little Italian. "My name is Julius Caesar, and we want to cross the border."
"Then I must examine the cage for contraband," said the authoritative Barrington.
He entered the cage up the 3 steps. The horse gave a little lurch. The cage door slammed. Now it was one of those tricky locks.
For hours they hammered and banged on the lock of the cage, and it was starting to snow. "Someone go and get an acetylene cutter," said Barrington, gripping the bars. "Mamma mia, no, that was a ruin of the lock."
"There's a locksmith in Pacoon," said Mr. Rich. "He's a retired burglar, and he wants to get his hand in again."
"Anything," said Barrington, "anything but get me out of this frightful cage."
There were puzzled farm workers who watched the cage with its attendants shouting, skipping alongside children. It had got to the poking him with a stick stage.
"Get away, Damio, get away! Have you done something wrong, mister? Or is it the murder? Have you got a disease?"
A pebble hit Barrington on his aristocratic ear.
"I say, stop that!"
Another pebble bounced off his neck.
"And stop that as well!"
This only provoked a shower of stones, orange peels, toffee papers, spit, sherbet sticks, and incessant tauntings. In a frenzy, under a non-stop barrage of ridicule and missiles, Barrington retaliated with a trick usually performed by enraged male chimpanzees in zoos. Soon the pony outstripped the penny-rich children, leaving them in their laughter-filled air. In the cage, Barrington nursed a stinging member that some little dead-eyed Dick had hit with a nettle. At a steady trot, Julio Caesar headed for Pacoon. God in heaven, what was this? Mr. Rich stood up, went vest white.
"Look! Look! Look!"
He pointed an obstetrical finger. There, coming down the hill, were McGillicuddy, Arpong, and Milligan. 3 terrified men, all on 1 bike. But wait, it was pursued. What was it?
Yes, the panther!
Julio tried to rein, but the pony had seen it too. About turned, whinnied, and bolted towards the border. The 3 men on the bike shot past the cart, screaming and saying the rosary. The panther changed its stride, leaped onto the cage, and started slashing down at the cowering Barrington. Hypodermic at the ready, Mr. Retch sat rooted with fear.
"Stick it in as a bomb!"
Mr. Retch stood up, stumbled and fell needle first into Julio's thigh. He gave one loud shriek, then fell into a deep, smiling-faced Neapolitan sleep. Hearing past them went a lorry with a Republican militia, the hooter clearing the way.
Beep, 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 beep.
At the wheel sat Sergeant Major Kevin Grady, who last week was only a private. His rapid promotion due to the discovery of his commanding officer's boots under his wife's bed. Every night since, he had looked under the bed for further promotion. All were now converging on the church, where Father Rudden now stood over 4 unconscious Ulster police, while a 5th had escaped at the border post and was shouting insults.
"You can have them back for £10 in the poor box," was the priest's reply, at which moment McGillicuddy and company, both brakes and all hope gone, shot into the churchyard and hit a tombstone. All 3 were catapulted up through the stained-glass window. Arpong fell unconscious on the organ keyboard, and a mighty atonal chord ensued. Milligan and the sergeant were hurled upwards into the middle of the organ pipes, which began to fall like iron rain, clinging and clanging into the empty aisle. Outside, the militia truck drew up with a screech and outshot a crowd in mixed uniforms who immediately threw a cordon around each other. Guffaws came from the troops at the customs post. Obviously, this enraged the Sergeant Grady, who barked,
"Take aim! 1 round over them silly laughing heads! Fire!"
To the accompaniment of clanging organ pipes, a volley rent the air.
"Ha!" said a crow.
"Help!" said Milligan on second thoughts. An organ pipe jammed over his head, having removed all thoughts of blasphemy. A return volley from the customs post whistled, and a bullet hitting Milligan's pipe, causing vibrations of 300 decibels in E-flat, didn't really help his temper. Soon, volleys of over-the-head fire from both sides were all the rage. Father Rodden ran up and down his line of Ulster police, hitting each one as they became conscious. "Look out!" yelled a voice. Into their midst galloped a horse, desperately trying to keep up with the cage it was pulling. Through the middle it plunged, scattering them all, flattening the custom shed, trampling the tents. The coffin and the shed burst into flames. At 4:32, the world of Pakoon erupted in a crimson-throated roar with screams, smokes, yells, and swears. Debris flew everywhere. The clock in the church suddenly struck endless ones, and hundreds of bats flew from their belfry. 150 feet up in the air, Arpong regained consciousness and blew his whistle. Father Rodden was blown backwards out of his boots, and McGilligatty's moustache and eyebrows were singed from his face. He hid his shame with a bucket over his head. The great bell fell from the tower and landed directly over Mr. and Mrs. Prells. "The night seemed to be closing in early these days, dear," he said. The dust and debris settled, and eventually a great silence settled over the land. 10 years have passed since that fateful day. 10 years of journey to their end, and Pakoon once again was lost in its unhurried ways. The church was restored by a rich Catholic, and Father Rodden found faith in a new pair of boots. The mute steeple clock once again ticked out with new life. The border posts were never rebuilt, and to this very day, no one is quite sure exactly where the border lies. In fact, each and every character in the picture returned to his or her own ways, all except one man, a certain Roman soldier hanging from a tree with a rusty organ pipe lodged over his head, from whence came a muffled voice.
"Here, you can't leave me like this."
"Oh, can't I?" said the author.
"Caw!"
said a crow, and for once Milligan was silent.